Welcome to the WBGO Journal. I'm Doug Doyle. Today we continue our Voices of Wellness series as WBGO's John Kalish reports on how the Care Cube is being shipped to hospitals' emergency departments.
Indentations in the walls of the Care Cube allow the arms of caregivers to reach in and touch the patient.
Commentator Mildred Antenor has her eye on a court case that could impact social media companies all over the globe.
These tech giants are accused of engineering infinite scroll and variable reward notifications to exploit dopamine in the adolescent brain.
And I'll chat with Tony, Emmy, and Grammy-nominated actress and singer Nikenji about her new Dorothy Dandridge musical.
Just knowing the history of her and how she was such a trailblazer allowed me to kind of dig in more about her life.
All this coming up today on the WBGO Journal. In 2020, at the height of the COVID pandemic, WBGO's John Kalish reported on a portable isolation unit called the Care Cube that promised to transform patient care. Now, after rigorous testing by the FDA, the Care Cube is being shipped to hospitals around the country, including Cooper University Healthcare in Camden. This week, the medical staff at the hospital showed us the Care Cube in the hospital's emergency department.
There are now dozens of Care Cubes at hospitals in California, Colorado, Minnesota, Maryland, Rhode Island, and New Jersey. Several Care Cubes will be available in Massachusetts next month. Cooper University Healthcare in Camden has three of them, and earlier this week, a doctor and nurse at Cooper University Hospital set one up to show me. The parts for each Care Cube fill three wheeled containers once it's assembled. The Care Cube is 7 feet high, 10 feet long, and 4.5 feet wide. The frame of the device is made of steel tubing, and for skin, sheets of a clear rubbery plastic known as TPU are used. Indentations in the walls of the Care Cube allow the arms of caregivers to reach in and touch the patient. They connected the steel poles to form the frame and attached to it the Care Cube's plastic skin, which is called the canopy. Zippers welded to the canopy seal the unit. A HEPA filter outside the Care Cube cleans the air inside of infectious particles. Dr. Simon Sarkisian is the director of disaster medicine at Cooper. He and a nurse named Timothy Galvin set up the Care Cube in about 20 minutes.
May we be knowledgeable about how to use it, but hopefully never have to use it. But we'll be ready in case we ever need to use it.
Dr. Sarkisian was at Cooper when the pandemic began and remembers the chore of changing in and out of PPE, the personal protection equipment needed to shield healthcare workers from contagious diseases. PPE includes gloves, masks, visors, and gowns. The Care Cube eliminates the need for PPE because it's sealed and, with the HEPA filter, is turned into a specially ventilated room whose air does not flow back out into the hospital. This is known in the infectious disease world as a negative pressure room.
Our initial plans involve placing a patient in one of these Care Cubes that will essentially turn any bed we have in our emergency department into a negative pressure bed, holding them here while Mr. Galvin and his team help set up a part of the field hospital where we can transfer this patient over there, because that 100-bed field hospital is also negative pressure, a little bit roomier, and will allow us to do a little bit more to take care of a patient. Hopefully, this never comes to it, but multiple patients as well.
Alex Lasky is the founder and CEO of Care Cubes. He says that his company's portable isolation unit not only eliminates the need to buy and dispose of PPE, it saves a lot of time for the doctors and nurses.
It allows nurses and doctors to get to the patient in 30 seconds rather than in the 7 to 8 minutes that they require to put on PPE.
And, says Lasky, it takes another 7 or 8 minutes to take off the PPE. He points out that at the height of the COVID pandemic, when hospitals were overwhelmed with infected patients, they were forced to defer care and thousands of people died from doing without the care they needed. Lasky says that having something like CareCube available would have gone a long way towards avoiding that predicament.
If you have sufficient deployable isolation capabilities that are flexible, and you can deploy the isolation care where you need it, when you need it, then it doesn't force you to make this Solomonic choice between, do I take care of my infectious patients or do I take care of everybody else? You should be able to do both.
The CareCube was refined over several years with funds from the CDC and DARPA, a division of the Pentagon. One key player in its development is the University of Nebraska Medical Center, which is a leading infectious disease research center. Other Lab, a San Francisco engineering firm known for incubating innovative tech startups, also helped bring CareCube to market. The CareCube is being manufactured in Minnesota to ensure a stable supply chain. With a growing rate of measles infection, as well as the effort and cost of contract tracing for people who test positive for the disease, Lasky says hospitals may want to employ CareCubes for patients with measles.
Putting aside the health implications of unmitigated measles spread, just the cost implications and the operational complexity of it means that hospitals should be desperate to isolate suspected measles patients as soon as practical so that there's less possibility of spread.
The CareCube costs more than $10,000. CEO Alex Lasky expects the cost of the CareCube to come down substantially in the months and years ahead. For the WBGO Journal, I'm John Kalish.
John Kalish's feature is part of WBGO's Voices of Wellness series, made possible in part by a grant from the Horizon Foundation for New Jersey. A landmark trial accusing tech giants of harming children with addictive social media is underway. WBGO commentator Mildred Antonor is paying close attention.
In late January 2026, a Los Angeles courtroom became the epicenter of a historic shift in how we define corporate responsibility. The trial is against Facebook, Meta, TikTok, and YouTube, alleging that their platforms deliberately addict and harm children. While TikTok and Snap settled just before the proceedings, the case against Meta and YouTube continues. The focus in the case are addictive design, mental health issues, and potential product liability. Now, according to some internal documents unsealed during the trial, they reveal that even the tech employees have described their own apps as drugs and themselves as pushers, much like the pharmaceutical industry's aggressive marketing of oxycodone. These tech giants are accused of engineering infinite scroll and variable reward notifications to exploit dopamine in the adolescent brain. And although in this digital age that we're living in, too much time on our phones and laptops is a growing problem for many of us, this crisis is not felt equally. In communities of color, the impact is compounded by a lack of alternative infrastructure. Recent data shows that Black non-Hispanic teenagers are significantly more likely to spend 4 or more hours daily on screens compared to their white peers. Now, additionally, while affluent families may have the resources to trade screen time for extracurriculars or private therapy, marginalized youth often rely on these platforms as their primary or only social and recreational outlet. The core of the legal debate is whether tech companies should be held liable for the specific mental health disparities appearing in minority youth. Critics argue that these platforms are identity neutral, but the outcomes are anything but. If an algorithm is designed to maximize engagement at any cost, and that engagement leads to higher rates of depression in populations already lacking access to mental health care, then that algorithm is now a tool to make the issue worse. It's called corporate irresponsibility. Legal experts suggest that by failing to warn users of the addictive nature of these features, companies may have created a public nuisance. And I agree, these social media companies are now accomplices to a growing mental health issue for minority youth who are 2 to 3 times more likely to experience suicidal ideation when suffering from social media addiction. The stakes are not just academic, they are existential. If these companies are found liable, it could trigger a massive redistribution of resources, forcing the social media companies to fund the very mental health services that their products have strained. Without such a shift, we risk creating a generation of marginalized youth whose mental health has been excavated for data and profit and left with the bill for a crisis that they didn't design. I'm Mildred Antenor.
Mildred Antenor is a professor and the author of The Gladioli Are Invisible, a memoir.
It's wonderful. It's marvelous. You should care for me. It's awful nice. It's paradise. It's what I love to see. You've made my life so glamorous. From now on, my heart's feeling amorous. Oh, it's wonderful. It's marvelous that you should care for me. Come on.
It's a great time to be Nkenji. The internationally acclaimed songstress, the Tony, Emmy, and Grammy Award-nominated singer. She is not only starring, but it is her entire concept. That's Love, the Dorothy Dandridge musical, the world premiere running from February 19th through March 8th at the Axelrod Performing Arts Center in Deal, New Jersey. She's also out with her new album, Center Stage, live from the Ella Fitzgerald Festival. It's my pleasure to welcome Nkenji to WBGO. Great to see you.
Great to be here. Thank you so much for having me. And wow, 2026 is going to be an exciting year for all of us.
Let's talk about Dorothy Dandridge, certainly a pioneer when it comes to musicals. She was the first ever Black woman to receive an Academy Award nomination in the category of Best Actress. As I mentioned, a trailblazer. When you started to look into the life of Dorothy Dandridge, what impressed you?
I grew up watching her movies, you know, when they would always do these reruns of Porgy and Bess and Carmen Jones. And I just remember being so stunned and fascinated with her beauty and her talent and just how she made everything look so easy and seamless and just perfect, like just perfection. And that's when I first got introduced to her as a kid. And of course, hearing about her, you know, my parents being big fans of her and their friends and family. So just knowing the history of her and how she was such a trailblazer allowed me to kind of dig in more about her life. When I was working with Berry Gordy Jr. on Motown, I remember him saying, "I'm bringing Motown to Broadway and not Broadway to Motown." And when I was working with him and kind of being behind the scenes of how the show was being developed and the script writing, I realized that there wasn't a lot of representation of us on Broadway and beyond, you know, there just wasn't. And of us, of like real live Black icons. And I consider Dorothy Dandridge to be an icon, part of the American history, but also a international star. She performed all over the world. She was received and just always in the biggest light. So when I started reaching into the history around her and what made her tick and finding out so much information about when she was with the Dandridge sisters and then also being a single mom, being married with Harold Nicholas, but then when the Nicholas brothers went to Paris, like many other Black artists were doing, like Josephine Baker, I mean, the list goes on. She decided to stay in America. She said, this is my home. This is where I'm going to make it. And she did, but she was doing it with a child that was a special needs child, having 24-hour nursing care at her home to take care of her daughter, Lynn, which is at the time of the 50s, unheard of. They would put special need kids in facilities. So that was something that was really admiring to me, being a mom as well, like seeing like the love that she had for her daughter. And that love for her daughter is what kept pushing her to want to be something bigger, make a difference in life. And she changed the world. She changed the business. And I'm just so grateful to have the opportunity to showcase her story on stage.
Yeah, it really is an intimate story. And it's already received significant acclaim, beginning with two sold-out nights at Carnegie Hall. That tells you something right there. Not only are you starring in this, but you conceived this whole idea. So this was really important to you.
Yes, absolutely. It's very, very important to me to elevate her life, to elevate her story. She should be a household name. People should say, oh, Dorothy Dandridge, of course I know her, right? I mean, it's Billie Holiday, Ella Fitzgerald, like those are her contemporaries. So I want to make sure that we bring this Hollywood life of Dorothy that was, you know, here in America and beyond to the forefront. And we have an amazing creative team that is on board. All of our creatives are Tony, Grammy, and Emmy-winning creatives that are really passionate about Dorothy's life and just putting all of their heart and soul in this project, from set design to music to choreography. It's just a really great celebration of her life, and then also showcasing just the journey of what made her who she was. It wasn't an easy task, and I'm so fascinated with all the decisions that she made to make her name known.
And it's another example of the wonderful showcase of New Jersey when it comes to having creative performances. You talked about all the cast and the production crews. You're a Tony, Emmy, and Grammy Award nominated performer. Jersey gets the best of what New York has a lot of times, and in this case, it is again.
Yes, I live in New Jersey. I have love for New Jersey, and I also have love for New York because I'm born and raised in New York as well, Bronx and Brooklyn, and did all my schooling there at Juilliard and Manhattan School of Music and LaGuardia High School and Harlem School of the Arts. So all of my, like, I didn't want to leave New York, you know. It's like, why go away when all of the knowledge and education I can have right here? And then I moved to New Jersey, oh my goodness, like 2007 or 2008. And I just fell in love with this beautiful state. And it's just such a wonderful melting pot of culture in New Jersey. And I'm just grateful that we are able to collaborate with Axelrod Performing Arts in Deal, New Jersey. It really is a beautiful theater there. It's a 500 seat, very intimate, perfect for our show. I actually was an artist there. I did Meta in Newsies many years ago. That's how I got connected to Axelrod and Andrew DePrisco. And even then, I was already had my thoughts on developing a show around Dorothy Dandridge. I was always told I needed to find a producer who could do this for me. And, you know, it got to the point where I was like, I'm just going to do this myself. And I did. And, you know, sometimes we have to always realize that even if we don't always have the tools in front of us, but if you have the passion behind it, you just make it happen. And that is exactly what we did. And I'm just grateful that Andrew from Axelrod kept always asking, what's happening with the Dorothy Dandridge musical? Like, he was kind of checking in as we were developing the show. And it's all about timing, and we figured that this was the right time to bring it to Axelrod to make its world premiere. And also we want to push the students and the community. My nonprofit's all about supporting BIPOC stories, so we are getting people who's been making donations to the Nkenji Foundation to sponsor kids for $25 a student so that they can see the show for free and be able to meet and greet the cast. So it's all about telling her story, celebrating her life, educating people, and supporting the community as we do it, all in one big circle of love.
That's great. Nkenji, what have you learned about yourself through this whole process of the Dorothy Dandridge musical?
I learned that I can multitask very well. I've learned a lot about really connecting to who Dorothy was during that time, especially since there's so many parallels about us, being moms, being Black women, being in the arts, advocating for ourselves. I feel that there's so many things that she's done, and even though it seems like it was so long ago, it's so relevant to what we have to deal with socially and politically now in our lives. So it's just learning to be able to embrace the wonderful things that come with this project and also the scary things that come with this project, and knowing that you just have to take things day by day. I'm just really grateful to have an amazing team. Like Christina Saju is directing this with me. She was a co-director on the Louis Armstrong musical on Broadway last year. Ray Mercer is our choreographer. He's in The Lion King, and he's from the Alvin Ailey School, and came from a pre-production of rehearsals with the dancers, and the choreography is just divine. And he's just perfect for this because I wanted to have that classiness of Dorothy Dandridge, but I also wanted to have some edge to the choreography and some class. So it's kind of like mixing that 40s, 50s, 60s to 2026. We have a two-time Emmy winner, Trey Ellis, who is a book writer as well as a co-lyricist. Grammy winner Shelton Becton, who is the composer and co-lyricist, and Grammy winner Everett Bradley, who is the arranger and also an amazing percussionist that has played, on the big stages with all the biggest pop stars. So we have that creative team that has really been the heart and soul of building this project.
You mentioned Motown the musical that you were in and on Broadway. So when you think of Broadway and you think of something like the Axelrod Performing Arts Center, different kind of venues and different challenges that come because of that. How has that been for you?
Well, I think that it's important when you are creating something brand new from ground up that you have to be flexible. And when you are working with a theater, you want to see what are the advantages of that theater. Obviously, when I was doing Motown at the L'Enfantine, there's over 1,000 people in that theater, and big balcony and big stage, and it's Broadway, right? But this theater at Axelrod, the Axelrod Performing Arts Center, is 500 seats and is very intimate. And that is what we want when we do a regional production. Like, we're not trying to fill 15 to 2,000 seats when it's a brand new show. Anyone who wants to support, new theater and new music and new art and be able to elevate this woman's name and her legacy, who's our history, then, this is the show for you. If you want to see beautiful costumes and a beautiful set, our set designer is Adam Koch, and he did the set for Louis Armstrong on Broadway. Come and see Dorothy Dandridge. If you want to cry and laugh and just feel so many emotions from beginning to end about the journey and her friendship with Marilyn Monroe and hearing some amazing tap dancing by the Nicholas Brothers and hearing this gorgeous music and seeing an Oscars moment on stage, come and see That's Love, the Dorothy Dandridge musical, because this is a show for all ages, all walks of life, and anyone who is human and wants to be able to feel something.
Can't wait for it. Now, I want to take you back a little bit. I want to take you back to fifth grade. I want to take you back to PS 95 in the Bronx. You're a good man, Charlie Brown, and my guest today was selected by her teacher, Barbara Hartnick, as Peppermint Patty.
Yes.
Tell us about that, because you have said that's when you knew, hey, this is the life you wanted to lead, as you know, as a star on Broadway, as a singer. The lights went on, didn't they, at that point?
It did. It did. I was a 10-year-old that was going through a lot. There was a lot of changes happening at home for me. That was the year that my biological father left us, and on New Year's Eve, and my mom became a single mom. And that was also the year that my mother decided to start her own business, her own staffing agency. And it was also the year that I was playing the auditions for the fifth grade class play of You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown. And never at that time have I sung. I was always in dance classes, piano lessons, karate classes, everything. I loved to draw. I was a big artist. I loved visual arts. And I was just humming the song that everyone was listening, having to audition with. It was called Poor Sweet Baby. And my teacher, Miss Hartnick, heard me singing, and she said, "Nikenji, you are our Peppermint Patty." And doing that role like really changed my life, because I was being teased a lot in school, bullied a lot, just because, as we all know, like when you're a little different, people, instead of some kids, instead of embracing the difference, they make fun of you. I was born with ptosis on my eyes, so as people would know it as lazy eye. So I'd have one eye completely closed, and I'd have patches on my eye, and I was going through operations. It's a lot for like a child to go through. So on top of that, kids weren't very nice. They were very, very mean to me, and I'd have glasses being flushed down the toilet. I mean, there was like the things I went through. And it just kind of gave me a way of building, elephant skin. I was like, I had to tough it out, and
And where are they now?
I
I'm curious,
Exactly.
is Miss Hartnick still around?
She is still around.
Do you
She
keep in
is.
touch?
I do keep in touch with her. I haven't been in touch with her recently, but I will. Thank you for bringing her up, because I absolutely want her to come to opening night, because she is the one who planted the seed. And I have been in contact with her since then. She's come to some of my shows. Even when I talk about her in my shows, I always like make note, and sometimes I'm like, "And Barbara Hartnick is right in the audience," and I'd make her stand up and receive applause from the guests, so she's been really supportive. And I truly, truly, oh, and that's why I always say education and teachers are so important in our kids' lives, because, if you're destined for something, eventually it comes to you, but sometimes it comes sooner when someone's a little more in tune into your talent. And Barbara Hartnick noticing that talent that wasn't noticed by my family, because there was so much going on in my family at the time. It really was an outlet for me to be seen. Another reason why I was being teased, because I was really tiny. So at 10 years old, I looked like I was 7. So I was the first kid on the line. It's always the shortest one that starts the line. It's just like the little. And then as soon as I opened my mouth and sang and got a standing ovation at PS 95, it was like a wave of like, wow.
My guest today has been Nikenji, who is starring. in That's Love, the Dorothy Dandridge musical that she has put together, the world premiere running from February 19th through March 8th at the Axelrod Performing Arts Center in Deal, New Jersey. Thanks so much and continued success.
Thank you so much for having me.
You can see my entire conversation with Nkenji on the WBGO YouTube channel.
I'm wild again beguiled again. A simpering, whimpering child again. Bewitched, bothered, and bewithered. Am I?
Thanks for listening to the WBGO Journal. I'm Doug Doyle. Join us next Saturday morning at 5:30 for another edition of the award-winning WBGO Journal. In the meantime, stay tuned to the world's greatest jazz and blues station, WBGO and WBGO.org.